Welcome back to the Get a Grip on Lighting podcast. On today's show, we have Brad Kerner. Brad has had a 20-year com Hello, Brad. Has had a 20-year career in architectural lighting design and innovation in lighting technologies. He was at Philips Lighting in the innovation and corporate venture groups. The lighting market manager for Color Kinetics and a lighting designer in the Boston area at Lamb Partners, Light This, Rip and Ripman Lighting Consultants. For the past several years, Brad has been helping companies drive product innovation via his firm, Kerner Design. Brad received his master's in arch of architecture degree from Harvard University, where he received the IALD Education Trust Fund grant and the IESNA Richard Kelly grant. His last name is pronounced Kerner. It says that right on the bio there, so I'm just letting everybody know it's Brad Kerner. But before we get to our interview with Brad, Greg, I think we got to get a little crazy here with the craziest folks in lighting. That's right, TCPI.com.
And I think today the topic might revolve around sustainability. We'll see where we get, but that's a company that's sustainable in terms of what Mike and I think of sustainability. That's light bulbs, replaceable light bulbs, and they've got them, and they've got depth on everything. And what I mean by depth is every color, every wattage, every shape, every size, and even beyond. A lot of things that other people don't have, including high CRI on their bypass LED tubes, which nobody else has. And then on a lot of their A lamps as well. So they're really thinking it through and making the best LED light bulb replacement products out there.
And you can't forget the corn cob killer, which is absolutely an arrow that every lighting distributor, lighting contractor has to have in their quiver. What a great product. Comes in all the different HID, not all of them, but a lot of the different HID shapes and sizes, and it comes in 2200 Kelvin. That's right. For all you dark sky folks out there, darkness restoration and preservation folks out there, that's right. And of course, the National Association of Innovative Lighting Distributors, which Greg and I are members of, which you can be a member too if you have a warehouse, an order desk, and a counter sales. That's right. You need to have a couple things. Not anyone can join Nailed. It's not open happy hour at Nailed. You have to be a distributor. So we've had a lot of applications from all you folks that listen to the show. We love you, all you guys that listen to the show, but you have to have a warehouse. That's probably the basic consideration, Greg, wouldn't you say?
I would say so. Get that
And
warehouse moving.
yeah, join us in Dallas, Texas for our convention. Go to NAILD.org to register. How you doing, Brad?
Good, good. Beautiful sunny day here in the Netherlands. In fact, it's been weeks of sunshine. We're in the middle of a drought, so it's
No.
Palm Springs weather here in the Netherlands. It's crazy.
So you've Mike gave you a little bit of your bio, but you're currently at Lucept, is that correct? Or the editor of Lucept?
Yeah, Lucept is just my personal blog that I've kept forever and ever. That's just a total hobby thing that
Got it.
I think there's like 100 people get my blog posts for that, and some of my old colleagues seem to enjoy that. It's more of my innovation notebook than anything else. I left Color Kinetics back in 2008. I think I had ambitions to start my own lighting firm, and Lucept was going to be the name. So I started the blog as the marketing, but then I had kids and Lucept never got farther than the blog. So,
What were you
but
thinking of
it's my
starting in
place for
2000?
speculating on the. Sorry?
Oh, in 2008, what made you think that you should start something? What were you looking at doing?
Well, I was just coming off of my time at Color Kinetics, and back then, CK was just the leader in the industry. And even in hindsight, we were 5 years ahead of the rest of the industry. We had such great access to all the state-of-the-art LED stuff from all the manufacturers. We saw a lot of the early white lighting that was there, from Cree and Osram, and you name it. We saw the absolute state-of-the-art. So it was obvious that everything was going to become LED lighting even as far back then. And I had done a product that was a ultra shallow surface-mounted downlight. And it had a 15 or 25 degree beam and under 2 inches, which you couldn't do in any other light source back there at the time. This might seem quaint in hindsight by today's adoption of LEDs, but back then that was revolutionary. And I was just thinking that'd be a great product to turn into a whole line, sort of retrofit, surface mounted ceilings, ultra shallow. You could do a whole line of decorative stuff with it. And honestly, still to this day, that hasn't really been done. There's still a category waiting there, I think, for surface mounted retrofits that are a little more decorative, have a little more presence to them. But now it's a lot easier. Back then, you had to do a heat sink, you had to do a custom driver, you had to do a whole bunch of custom optics. Now you can just go to a catalog and bolt it together in about a half an hour and be done with it. Mm-hmm. So
that was then. And I was looking at some of the files you sent in. You did a PowerPoint in 2014 called The Evolution of Adoption. And there were some interesting slides.
Yeah, for the U.S. Department of Energy.
Yeah.
Yeah, so... I've heard some of your previous podcasts, and you're talking a lot about sustainability and lighting, and that's been very near and dear to my heart. Again, it goes back to the LED revolution. So, you know, I'm just old enough that when I started lighting, it was pre-LED revolution. So I joined Rittman Lighting as an intern, and I learned all of the old-fashioned light bulbs, all the old-fashioned technologies. And then I was kept up with Color Kinetics and finally joined them in 2005. So I got to see that sort of vanguard of that LED tech coming in. Some of the first white lighting products, all of the RGB stuff, you know, we had great stuff. And even back then, we had some really brilliant guys who were running it. A lot of PhDs in robotics from Carnegie Mellon was the original, you know, five or six founders of the company. And they would speculate on the future. And we would do these very simple mental things like, you know, we know LEDs are riding the cost curve of semiconductors, so they're going to plummet down to virtually nothing as a percentage of the cost of the fixture. So when LEDs become free, how will you use them? I mean, we were asking these questions in 2005, right? Wow. You start to say, well, we'll use a lot of them. We'll use multiple circuits, multiple optical patterns within a single fixture. We'll spread them out. We'll spread the heat out. You know, we knew you could see a lot of that forecasted very early on. So then the DOE asked me to speak at some of their R&D workshops, and I think it was as early as maybe 2013 even, they asked me to speak on the next evolution of adoption, right? So the U.S. Department of Energy was one of the key catalysts for the adoption of LEDs in the United States, frankly, globally. They had a tremendous team in place. So I speculated back then. I said, the next evolution of adoption, so they want to keep driving LEDs so that they drive energy efficiency. That's the DOE's mission, right? I said, if we embrace sustainability, right, you know, true sustainability, if you look at what everything is said about sustainable practices, should reduce costs. It's not a cost adder. It's not a luxury add-on to a product. It is fundamental, controlling your supply chains, controlling, simplifying your products. It should take a lot of costs out, and that should drive further adoption. So I made this very nice presentation, and it really won over the hearts and minds. I mean, this is a pretty hardcore crowd of manufacturers that were there. And then, you know, I asked me to come back again a year later, and I did that. And they even changed their DOE R&D funding roadmap to add a section on sustainability for fixtures in there. Right. I often joked it was easier for me to change the U.S. federal government than it was for me to change Philips Lighting at the time, because I did a project for a sustainable fixture that I couldn't get off the ground. But what happened, if you guys remember the history, is right. So China happened. Right. So around that same time, the early 2010s, China strategically set LEDs as a national technology priority. And I remember the statistics. I forget where I got this quote. It was from one of the consultants of the DOE, but you know, China at one point was dumping $1 billion per year in subsidies into the LED market, right? The whole global lighting market is only $90 billion for everything sold that's electric lighting in every format. So, you know, you just had this double whammy of trying to get the efficacies of the white sources up to beat fluorescent, to beat metal halide. So there was this obsession with efficiency at all costs in the product design, right? Mm-hmm. This is where the lack of modularity comes from. Mm-hmm. It came from that. It was the lighting specifiers looking for the two-year ROI for the retrofit market. Product managers saying, well, you have to hit these numbers, forcing the engineers to become obsessive with efficiency design, right? And they wanted to optimize putting the LEDs directly on a big old heatsink. And that was it. They didn't want modules. They didn't want anything getting in the way. So that there was that pressure. And then the other pressure was China was just dumping LEDs. And then they started to move up the food chain and started dumping fixtures into the market. So rather than my prediction of going towards sustainability, the whole market just went downhill. and chased quality and cost to the bottom of the barrel, right? And we're left now, you know, 10 years later with the legacy of that, that the vast majority of LED lighting fixtures are just made as disposable consumer junk, right? You just, it burns up, you throw it out. There's no maintenance, there's no accessibility, there's no modularity to it. It's just super frustrating to me, right? I mean, I very briefly did a stint at Micron, a huge semiconductor company, when they wanted to launch an LED group back in 2010. And as part of that, I got to participate in the Zaga Consortium, the earliest days, right? So Philips, I believe it was Osram, started it, right? And then immediately a whole bunch of all the other lighting majors, both in Europe, the United States, GE, all of the, you know, Zoom, Tabol, everybody was a part of it. All the new Asian tigers joined in, Samsung, LG, you name it. They were all part of that. And they invested millions of dollars sending these engineers to these standards boards, right? For a while there, they were meeting every 6 weeks, North America, Europe, and Asia, right? And we were doing that over and over again, trying to make these standards. And yet, you know, those standards sat there for a decade and were basically ignored by manufacturers and ignored by specifiers, right? The manufacturers all thought they were going to be clever. They didn't want to standardize. They all thought that they were going to be the big heroes that came up with the novel designs and their own IP, and they never wanted to just embrace like Philips or Osram standard LED module sizes, right? The specifiers never asked for it, right? So I spoke at the IALD Enlighten conference just this past year in Palm Springs. And, I joked with everybody. I said, I'm off the leash because I'm not working for a manufacturer. I'm not working for a designer. So I'm going to hold you all to task on sustainability. And I said, okay, Zaga has been around for a decade. How many of you specifiers in the room put it in your specifications?
How many know what that is? Would be the first question.
No one raised their hand.
No, how many even know what Zaga is? I mean, that's the real question, you know. Has anyone ever posed the idea of the sustainability of our relationship to our customers? You know, I mean, I work on the front lines, Brad, and you know, every time I just was in a dealership this last week, and they had five LED light fixtures out of whatever 20 or 30. And I wasn't sure if it was LED. I looked at it; it was really old. I wasn't sure if it was LED or induction. Okay, so I was like looking at
that bad, huh?
Yeah, you couldn't really tell. So we got one down, and you know, the driver's out on one, the step down transformer's out on the other, and the array is out on another one. There's three different problems with the fixture. The driver is no longer made. It's very difficult to find a driver that fits inside the box into the set screw pattern of the existing fixture. And there's a whole host of problems. And so in the past, that person would have bought a box of 250-watt metal halide light bulbs and changed the light bulb. Instead, and a lot of people don't think about, Brad, is the waste of electrical resources that all this is. Like, our tradesmen are busy building lots of wonderful things for us, including, you know, hopefully changing our energy grid and getting to, you know, to, you know, clean, cheap electricity that we can all use as much as we want of, which is really should be the goal, not this privation and starvation of our economy with expensive energy. We should really be after the cheapest, cleanest energy we can get. And instead, our electrical resources are trying to figure out what the hell's wrong with this stupid light fixture for hours at a time.
Charging, like I said, the race to the bottom in cost and quality. Yeah.
Race, it's really sad.
That's what happened. And, you know, what really frustrates me is I had to listen to the story from like 2005 on about all these sort of smart engineers and product leaders and various lighting companies all over the world not wanting to standardize. And they said, well, the technology is changing too fast. They don't want to standardize yet. Well, that's garbage. That was a garbage argument then, and it was a poor decision throughout. I mean, here's how far Color Kinetics was ahead of the industry. That my boss was Kevin Dowling, who did a lot. He wrote the LM79 and LM80 standard drafts for the congressman back then. He helped them draft the L Prize. We had a recessed downlight prototype that was 4 inches deep, so it could be retrofit. It was 1,000 lumen. 4-inch aperture downlight, 2700K DALL-E 0 to 10 DMX dimming. This was 2006. We had these prototypes. We had a module inside that was roughly a 4-inch diameter module. Very simple. It was just basically a 4-inch diameter heatsink plate with a very simple screw thread on the outside. And in the middle was a spot for like a generics, I forget, Molex connector or something like that. And Kevin had the good sense. He was doing all this stuff with the DOE and these standards committees. He's saying, we need a standard for that. Just that. Not the LED technology, just the heatsink connection. This is not rocket science. And honestly, I'm so aggravated these people that say, oh, but it was, you can't standardize technology. You could have put a halogen source in there. You could have put a fluorescent source in there. It made no difference. So Kevin even put it into NEMA as a standard proposal. No, the other manufacturers wanted to hear it.
Like they if just you don't, didn't if want you don't to, have
they
standardized,
they didn't want to deal with it.
If you don't have standardization, you can't have commoditization. And so, and people, oh, we don't want to commoditize our products. Commoditization is at the heart of equity and delivering people quality products at a low cost. What if the manufacturers of electrical pipe decided to make them all different? What if plumbing pipe was made to all sorts of different standards and they didn't fit into, and they couldn't be fit together? This is a disaster for our industry. All this custom, everything's a custom made product. It's insanity. And we need to find a way out of this. Like there's going to be, you know, I don't know if there's going to be a backlash, but certainly it's a big, when you don't standardize, Brad, when you don't commit to long-term commoditization of your industry with replacement parts through distribution, through different channels, you end up with garbage. You end up with loads of way more garbage than you would have had you standardized. And it's a serious problem, and it's a moral problem for this industry, actually. I think it's a moral problem.
And I kind of want to jump in and just go back, Brad, if you don't mind, is so you talked about, you guys went to NEMA with this product in mind. How does it actually get to a point where something gets standardized? We've asked this question before, and maybe you can help us in the industry kind of answer that. How could it have worked?
Yeah, so I wasn't part of that parse process. Mm-hmm. I don't know how NEMA works. I can tell you exactly how Zaga worked. So first off, it was, I believe, you're testing my memory, it was Phillips and Osram. Their team somehow got together and said, hey, let's do this. Then they had to create a nonprofit independent organization, and they made it open for everyone, right? Otherwise, you get collusion, monopoly. So you have to be very precise about how you start that. But then Zaga became an independent nonprofit organization. So you had these meetings, everybody would come in, they would propose something. So do you know the one of the most successful Zaga standards was the sort of 2-inch spotlight module, right? Where you have the little chip on board spot in the middle with the plastic surround, and either has 2 or 3 bolt holes in it, right? That's been pretty widely used in spotlights, downlights, track fixtures, and all that. Well, Phillips had one, Osram had one. So they both get in front of the group, proposed it. Here's what we think. Here's what our recommendation is. Everybody says, okay, well, there's two manufacturers that are proposing this type of thing. Let's vote. Do we want to do this as a new working group? They voted to do that. So they set up a working group to hash out, you know, what the proposal is, and then the rest of the organization would vote on it. Now, what's really humorous is, you know, Phillips and Osram were pretty, you know, they'd match each other. They had the history of always matching the lamps, the old lamp standards, mm-hmm. right? Because nobody wanted a proprietary lamp. So they always had to standardize that. So they knew the game. I think it was Phillips that had 2 holes and Osram had 3, you know, and they had to argue with each other over whose standard was right, because they had just launched these products onto the market. If it was a few months earlier, they probably could have settled this in some backroom conversation and be done with it. They spent months arguing. So the actual Zaga book, I think, has like 4 holes so that you can do either 2 or 3. That's how, you know, that's how you make the sausage, right? I mean, you don't, that's designed by committee and, you know, but I mean, it was a pretty rigorous, open discussion. I proposed a linear module on behalf of Micron. I said, I foresee that we'll need a snap-in linear module that has a sort of rigid base. And I worked with BJB, the socket manufacturer, and Then we looked at linear boards and we made a working group. So then we had a subcommittee where we made like, well, we know we need linears. You know, everybody wants these linears. Is it just going to be a blank PCB? Should it be a PCB in a housing? Does it have to have electrical connectors? What's the standard on that? You can imagine this takes a lot of effort and investment to standardize anything like that, mm-hmm. right? I mean, there's, you know, the old like triple tube fluorescent sockets. I mean, there's an amazing amount of engineering that went into one of those things. And to standardize mm-hmm. that so that everybody's modules and lamps, or sorry, sockets and lamps were modular and would guarantee that they work. That's quite an investment on the lighting industry. And, you know, in the old days, the cash flow of the replacement lamp business funded that.
Sure.
Right. So you had the big three, GE, Osram, Sylvania, and a host of sort of secondary guys. They all did that. And they had the cash flow. They could easily absorb lots of very smart engineers working all over the world to do that. Well, that's gone, right? The replacement business is gone. Now you send all the lamp manufacturing to China. So that whole cash flow for the industry, that source of R&D funding is gone now. Right. So to me, the lighting industry is in a really dark place, no pun intended. Right. I was joking. I was in Palm Springs, right? I held everyone to task. Reps in North America are also part of the triumvirate of problems because they want their damn spec locks on every project. Mm-hmm. So they're the worst offenders that they don't want any industry standards. Right. The rest of the world uses DALI, the rest of the world uses CE standard for safety. The rest of the world has tons of standards that are not used in North America. You got to ask yourself, why is that? Right. I think it was famously Lutron. I want to say back, this is really dating me, 2001 or something, launched an ecosystem or something like that. And somebody told me secretly inside, it's just DALI. They don't want to admit it, or they gimped it so that they would make it purposely not interoperable. You have to wonder, why would any manufacturer do that? But in North America, that makes perfect sense because the reps want it. So you have cash flow, the lamp, replacement lamp market's gone. You have people fighting against industry standards, so you have no volume. No volume means you don't get VCs interested in the market. They're not putting money in. You know, the whole LED revolution was real frothy and buzzy. It got a lot of people dumping mm-hmm. VC capital into it, particularly, you know, CK exited $792 million to Philips. Everyone wanted to do that again. So there's a lot of investment thrown in that's not there anymore. So, you know, to me, we're kind of back to square one in the industry. And I say, you know, sustainability is going to be now because they're forced to do it. There's no profits left. There's no volume left. The only way you can innovate now is you have to respond to these sustainable regulations, the demand coming out of the architecture market, the lighting specifiers. So, you know, that's not a bad thing. You know, what I was trying to share is I did these projects like a cradle-to-cradle fixture at Philips I did 2013, 2014. Then I did the bamboo pendant entry for the DOE, which won their grand prize. I put that on LinkedIn. I got 10,000 impressions on the post. I get tons of buzz around that. And then Sean Darris from LuxTech saw that. He recruited me, and I spent a year working with him and his team, and they were already working on what became Lightly, which launched now, right? And this sustainable product design is not rocket science. And in fact, there's just a few key concepts here that we should discuss, because I was listening to some of your earlier podcasts, you know. But number one, perfect is the enemy of the good, right? There's a lot of smart, well-intentioned individuals throughout the industry, specifiers, manufacturers, engineers, that like they don't take the obvious steps, right? If you can make something 80% better, but you still can't improve the last 20%, they won't do it because it's not perfect. And you hear that over and over and over again. And people just stonewall, or they won't get started because they're just obsessed with perfection. And that's toxic. Another pun. That's toxic. Bad way to do it, right? So you got to beat that. The other notion is, you know, William McDonough was this very famous architect who wrote the Cradle to Cradle Standard. And I was lucky that I went to University of Virginia undergrad for architecture, and he was the dean of the School of Architecture when I was there. So we got to see a lot of these fundamental sustainable principles. And what he's a genius at, I really watch his speeches. He's made tons of TED Talks and speeches over the years. He beautifully ties sustainability with economic success. Like, sustainability is not like doing your taxes. It's not like this tedious compliance thing that's just costly and it's just miserable and adds money and no one wants to do with it. Sustainability should be a beautiful thing. It should be
about
gorgeous
abundance.
Design.
It's about
abundance. Abundance. Yes.
Sustainability
that's his
is about abundance.
The words he uses.
Yeah.
Right. So you know, he has a beautiful chart where it's like a bar chart. And on the bottom, it's a bunch of red lines going below zero. And that's like less bad. Then on the other side, there's a bunch of green bars going up and that's more good. Right. So greenwashing is just manufacturers doing less bad and saying they're sustainable somehow. Right. And that's basically the entire lighting industry's history because, oh, they're saving wattage. They're green. That was the whole LED.
The CFL,
right?
The CFL was a symbol of sustainability. Was a symbol.
Yes. Same
People
thing.
Used to put it on billboards and stuff. And I, even now, I got an email from a local regional thing that said, change your lights to LED. And the guy was holding a CFL up. It's like, I'm not kidding you. This is just a couple months ago. I should put it up on the show. But, you know, when you're talking about this the sustainability piece, when you talk about these, the people who took over the lighting industry, have you ever thought that through, that rebates and incentives, specifically prescriptive rebates, based on lumens per watt qualifications, based on these types of considerations, caused a lot of problems in the lighting industry, took the innovation and prescribed it to people and allowed them to enter using these lists from various one accreditation agency controlled this and demanded compliance with their list in order to have access to the retrofit and retrofit project market. And that created, among other things, tons of light pollution. It created situations where where expertise was reduced in the field, and what was promoted was one for one replacements with the highest wattage possible because that paid the highest rebate. And you had all these different scenarios where you had perversions of lighting design created by accreditation agencies that were chasing one metric, lumens per watt. And I think that was the biggest contributor to the problem.
For sure. I mean, you know, on the good side of rebates is that they do help nascent technologies get off the ground and scale, and that's needed for reducing the price and driving volume, right? So a lot of those, you know, the early efforts like the L Prize was another huge catalyst in the industry just to like smash everybody's impressions that those metrics were never going to be met or would 5 years away, and then suddenly Philips just did it. Right. It was actually not easy for Philips to do the L Prize inside. I know the whole story. It was a lot of the former CK guys who did it, along with the best of the electronics and phosphor guys within Philips. So it was really the best in the industry. But it was super important to like show the industry, this is the state of the art, right? You guys can't, the best of the best can't even keep up with how fast LEDs progressed, right? So then I do feel bad for the sort of casual people who need to use lighting but are not able to keep up with a technical revolution like that. And the rebates were sort of helpful. Now, what you went off, did they get too prescriptive? Did they get too tight? You know, maybe. Yeah, I don't know what the specifics. It was all over the world. There was various points,
Well, we reintroduced flicker. We reintroduced flicker as a problem in the lighting industry because of prescriptive rebates. You know, that was something that we had slayed with electronic ballasts and T8 and T5.
Well, I wouldn't say the rebates did that. I would just say people are cheap, and that's why they did that. Because
I would say that 99% of them were sold on a prescriptive rebate or of some kind. The second thing is prescriptive rebates, as is different from the L Prize. Okay, the L Prize is a rebate given to someone who, or an incentive or a prize given to somebody for creating a great product and being the various pros and cons of which are measured by experts. What I'm talking about is utility rebate programs where they abandon the engineered, where you in the past you would have to submit your project and say, you know, this is the energy savings we're projecting, and it was replaced by, if you use this product, you get this rebate. If you use that product, you get that rebate. And all of this was driven by lumens per watt. with very little concern to the history and knowledge of the lighting industry. And now you have thousands, millions and millions of light fixtures that have been bypassed with high voltage to the socket in various configurations, where you have, you know, double-ended bypass, single-ended bypass, single and double-ended bypass. And you have all these things out in the field where the contractors were asked to relabel these fixtures. Are the fixtures relabeled? How do you know when 277 volts going to the socket? What happens if you put a fluorescent tube in there? All these different problems are out there in the field right now, and I think they were caused by a lack of standardization, which was fueled by rebates, by these incentives and rebates, which were way early in terms of the technology, Brad. The technology wasn't ready for the consumer at that point. And we pushed it out there en masse as an entire industry. We were all drunk and high on our own crack. We smoked our own stash. I mean, people were running around in 2007. Light bulbs are going to last forever. And guess what? The average LED, what does it last? Greg, two fluorescent tube lives?
About, yeah.
2 4-foot fluorescent tube lives is what you get. Well,
if you know the technology, though, you know that the LEDs actually are not the parts that are failing. Right. LEDs do last forever. They're just a very solid state device. It's almost always the electrolytic capacitors, it's the driver components, and that's all predicated on cost, right? It's so funny. I mentioned the L prize. You know, those original lamps are still running, right? Mm. The DOE somewhere has a testing lab where they are absolutely still running with almost like an impossibly perfect, I think like 1 out of 100 or something failed after a bazillion hours. Engineering quality into this stuff is not rocket science. It's been known forever. I mean, it's the same thing that you could make a high quality HID ballast or a high quality fluorescent ballast or whatever. That didn't change. What changed was the mad rush to the pricing bottom driven by China and Asian imports. So you had all these companies stripped out quality, and they knew better. They knew exactly what they're doing on the compromises they had to make. You talking flicker? Flicker doesn't exist. That was solved decades ago. Mm-hmm. And fluorescent. It's the same thing with LED. They just stripped the cost out. That's what happened. So it really wasn't the technology part of it. It was the market forces that were just brutal. So
I don't think you've considered enough. I don't think you've considered enough the role of accreditation agencies. I don't think you've considered that enough, and I don't think you've considered that they all the utilities in North America adopted standards set by these accreditation agencies, and that allowed for the entrance of the Chinese.
You mean accreditation agency? You mean like designers' lights for them and that sort of stuff?
Or? Yeah. So they all adopted their standards, their quality products, the qualified products list, not the quality products list. But they all adopted this as their central control mechanism as whether something was a good LED light or not. And, the mass adoption, all those Chinese companies were allowed in through the DLC. That's where they gained access to the market. They came in through the DLC.
I'm not a fan of the DLC and various trolls at the gate, I call them, in the industry.
Ooh, okay.
Good word.
And there's a lot of people there.
I mean, listen. I'm getting
this
to
is,
the
this is the same thing I warned you when I was in Palm Springs. I said I'm off the leash. No PR person is holding me down.
Well, you're on the Get a Grip on Lighting podcast, buddy. You're welcome here.
Well,
so
here's what, like, let's turn this around. I don't know the street lighting in that world very well. I know a little bit of it, but let's talk about, like, for example, I was doing Lightly, which is indoor commercial office pendants, right? Which is a very different market, right? Mm-hmm. I have bitterly been opposed to. I understand lighting designers are very well intentioned trying to push the sustainability standards first. And as what I said in Palm Springs, no. Those happen last. The product innovation has to happen first. And you know what drives product innovation? It's you, the specifiers, demanding it. All right. That was my point in the Palm Springs and the ILD presentation. I said, this is not rocket science. And I said, almost all of the key stuff that makes these products sustainable, you could have been doing all along if you stopped to think about it. And I said, for the specifiers, are you asking for Zaga and modularity and repairability? That's not rocket science. There's nothing, you don't need a sustainability standard for that. I go, what about toxicity? What about the supply chain? Are you challenging these guys? Where are these materials from? And that could have been done for fluorescent lighting. I mean, that has nothing to do with LED technology or the state of the art, right? I said reps. I called reps out. I said, you know, you guys have geographic monopolies and you like your overage and all your fat profits you make. Well, why don't you drive local business? You know, why don't you help the specifiers and help the contractors source local lighting manufacturers for your local projects? Why don't you put that first instead of chasing overage, right? And then manufacturers, you know, what are they doing? You know, they can look at their products. They have no idea the materials that are even in their products, right? I said, I think on my slide was, I called it stump a salesperson. Just, you know, you're a specifier, you got some clown come into your office trying to push something sustainable. Say, I want a list of all the materials by weight in that fixture. The best
that's
going to happen is they're going to run back to their product team. Product team's going to run back to the engineering team. The best that most of these companies can do, the engineering team's going to give them the bill of materials. That's not what's the substance by weight. They have no idea what went into the chemicals that went into the powder coat paint. They have no idea the chemicals that went into the circuit boards. They have no idea the chemicals that are in the wiring. They had none of that because they've never had to care about that before, because all of those pollution costs and sustainable costs have been externalized. No one's ever been held accountable for that. Suddenly now they are. So now the life cycle costs are being internalized back into the industry. Now, oh, well, now suddenly a lot of people have to wake up because now money is on the line, right? So I said this very pointed comment now at the DOE presentations all the way, you know, 10 years ago and over, I said, you're a lighting manufacturer. And in 10 years from now, you get your lighting fixtures back on your loading dock after they've been used. Do you financially have to consider them a liability or an asset?
Well, okay. The couple notes I have to go through here. I got a bunch. But the first is, I am not a believer in extended producer responsibility. Okay. And I'll tell you why. Because, people have drank the Kool-Aid of extended producer responsibility. You know why? Not because it actually solves any problems. And Europe will tell us that they can only get to 40 to 50% recycling rates with the most effective EPR programs in the world. Okay? The most effective. The reason why they do EPR is because it's easy. And they don't actually have to recycle anything. So what happens with EPR programs and is they find the manufacturers in the jurisdiction or the importers of record, and they go to them, and there's a handful. You know, what is there in Ontario, really? Maybe 100 companies that import light fixtures and manufacture light fixtures that are majors. Maybe 100. You know, maybe there's $50 or $60 million in sales a year, whatever. And they tax them. Okay. And then they say to them, well, you have to recover your fixtures. The bottom line is I'm going to say this, Brad, extended producer responsibility can only get us to 30% or 40%. We need to extend the responsibility to the users, to the owners of the fixtures, because that ownership of that fixture has transferred from the manufacturer to the person that's using it. They have the benefit of that light fixture for whatever amount of years. They've used it, and all of a sudden, we're taking that off their hands. And you know what? Listen, I have recycled millions and millions and millions of light bulbs, and not millions of light fixtures, but millions of light bulbs in my career, okay? And you know what? These EPR programs that exist in Ontario, they have no idea what light bulb recycling is about. Absolutely no idea.
Yeah.
And they're taxing everybody, and they're not getting anything done, Brad. We need to change that model. I disagree with you on that.
I think we're agreeing.
Oh, we're agreeing. Okay.
I don't buy any of that either. And in fact, a lot of that, I think I made the comment in my ILD presentation, is a lot of hype around lighting as a service, I think is another term for what you're calling ERP, right? Where they're willing to take the fixtures back at the end of life. And that's what I was just saying, you know, is it an asset or a liability at the end of life? They're liabilities, right?
Totally.
They're not even worth a scrap metal because they have so much toxic garbage in it, so much electronic e-waste. They're a liability that has to be processed and handled like nuclear waste or something like that, right? That's
not
how
quite.
Bad our standard
not
practices
quite.
Are.
Not quite nuclear waste, but I mean, when you had a fluorescent troffer or strip fixture. You just, you know, in the past, there might have been a PCB ballast in that. But after that, that was beautiful scrap metal and wire. You didn't, you could, it could be returned to its material. You get these LED light fixtures back, and nobody knows what to do with this. The industry is completely unprepared for all of the qualified garbage that's coming our way. We have no idea what to do with it.
And in fact, in the old days, if leasing or lighting as a service, whatever form you call leasing, was so great, it would have worked better pre-LEDs.
Yes, I agree.
And the fixtures were more durable and all modular, and it didn't work then either. So it's not going to work now. So I don't buy that that's a solution. So what I've come to basically conclude is that wherever possible, lighting fixtures basically need to be designed as disposable using bio-friendly, compostable materials, basically. Like, you need to think of these things as having no value at end of life, so you want them to have no cost of disposal at end of life. So how do you do that, right? Now, of course, you guys cover a broad spectrum of lighting, right? So I'm obviously not starting with like a marine grade 500 watt spotlight.
Sure.
Right? That's a beast that will always take a massive amount of metal, sealing materials. But for sure, you notice I did my DOE competition as a linear indoor office pendant, right? Because it's free air. It's very easy to cool. You're spreading a lot of, don't have a lot of watts anymore because the watts per square foot is so low. You don't have a lot of watts to put in a fixture. So at best, you only have to dissipate 3 to 5 watts per linear foot. And anybody who's worked with these circuit boards knows you can just hang a circuit board in free air. And you can dissipate 5 watts in the environment. You don't need a heatsink to do that. And that's been known for a bazillion years. CK, all of our little 12-inch Cove sticks, they didn't have heatsinks in, and they were 5 watts, right? It had nothing to do with the LED technology. That's the thermal capacity that you're dissipating. Like the MR16 form factor, God, from 2005 on, every one of our CK sales guy, the number one product they wanted was a 50-watt equivalent LED MR16.
Tell me about it. Everyone wanted that.
But the reality was that envelope can dissipate 5 watts without active cooling or fans or anything. You get 5 watts. That's it. Doesn't matter what magic you have. It's 5 watts. So then it's just, well, you're starting at 45 lumens per watt back in the day times 5 watts. That's your output. Now you have 200 lumens per watt times 5 watts. That's your output of the same thing, right? So that's why I was able to kind of strip all this stuff away and say, you know, the other big principle here is tape strip is just eating the world of lighting, right? All of that, for any sort of, you know, you have points, lines, and planes are fundamental geometry of all light sources. So for linear stuff, tape strip is just eating the world, right? You don't need rigid boards anymore. This whole, you know, these manufacturers basically spent 15 years learning thermal design and all these tricks to extract every painful lumen per watt they could get, screwing the board down every 3 inches and all these toxic gap pads and all this garbage, you know, and optics that have to be precisely aligned with the LEDs to extract as much light as you possibly can. And that's all screwed down. And, you know, you can't undo one of these fixtures. The only thing you do with it is the end of life, you shred it and smelt it down, right? Well, now, okay, so now you have literally continuous lines of LEDs the size of grains of sand with chip on board that are, you know, 3 millimeter wide, perfect lines of light. You can spread the heat out, you know, a 10 millimeter wide LED strip can easily handle 5 watts per foot. I think it's more. I want to say it's 6-7 watts, no heat sink. I just a tape strip. The mass is, there's no mass to it. It's, you're talking a 0.5 millimeter thick. There's hardly any copper. There's hardly any plastic, and it can dissipate the heat. So you're running 230 lumen per watt parts, right? That's common. You can buy that on DigiKey nowadays if you want, right? And it's only going higher. So you just put that together and you're like, I can just take a tape strip and put it down on wood and get the exact same performance. I can get 10 times the performance that I got of a Zoomtable Spheros fixture with T5HO back in 2003. Right? So just get rid of all that garbage. I don't need it. I don't need lenses. I don't need all that crap. Just, it's gone. So I don't need a sustainability standard that I have to comply to, because my fixture, I guarantee those lightly fixtures, you can put any sustainability standard you want, they're going to exceed it, because there's nothing to it except poplar wood from Eastern Pennsylvania, paint that's so eco-friendly, we have a picture of the manufacturer eating the paint because it's just all natural oils, right? We've stripped the electronics out too. This is the other big concept. I think you saw I talked about DC power, right?
Yeah, I saw that.
This is a no-brainer to me that you don't need a gigantic AC to DC LED driver slathered on with a whole digital signal on top of it and all this wireless garbage. For the vast majority of architectural lighting fixtures, I'm going the exact opposite way of the IoT thing. I'm saying we should strip as much out of these fixtures as we want. Like, you know, IoT, I've always can't stand it.
Amen,
the
brother.
Wireless, the PoE, all that stuff. That was basically the lighting industry trying to shove a bunch of robotic IP connected light sources down the throats of these construction industries with the hope of making these long-term revenue plays. No one asked the construction industry what they wanted. They sure as hell never wanted really expensive fixtures that were miserably complex with acute upfront costs and some nebulous.
Where have you been for the last 5 years, buddy? Where have you been for the last 5 years? So, okay. Holy crap.
But if that's not,
I couldn't,
right,
you've been listening to the Get a Grip on Lighting podcast. That's what you've been doing. We've been talking about this forever, Brad. It's awesome. We haven't even got into lighting controls that can't agree on a damn protocol. And they're all making their own, as if they're software companies or something. It's crazy.
Go back to my slides from the DOE, 2013. This is what I said. I said, you're going to strip this. You need to get rid of the electronics, right? Okay. We know that you need some electronics because you have to have current control for the LEDs, right? Mm-hmm. So you can't, think in the old days, you could just take an Edison lamp and plug it into the wall outlet and it worked. You didn't need any
nothing
electronics.
That's what you're telling with DC. So you're saying that you want everybody to adopt DC for lighting. So the buildings will just run off this DC power everywhere.
So here's the reality of modern buildings, right? So it is now cheaper for building owners to buy power from solar panels on their roof than it is from the grid in most places around the world. And it's plummeting. So that's the cheapest place to buy power. So that's a no-brainer. Battery storage, cheap, plummeting. You're going to generate your own power. You're going to store it. So that's all DC. You don't want to go onto an AC grid. Everything in the modern building is DC. Think about it. Every light source, sensor, hardware, variable speed motors are DC. Everything is DC.
We're wasting so much on inversion. Yeah. We're wasting so much.
So you have this AC bus bar sitting in the electrical closet. Everything is converted on and off of that, but it's all DC. So just make that go DC. High voltage, we're talking 350, 380, 750 volts DC. This is real power. This is not kid stuff. But you get rid of all that inversion. Okay. You need some AC legacy outlets for, you know, whatever. You just put an inverter back on those. The other 95% of the building is running natively DC. So the next concept you need to understand, and I for example, here in the Netherlands, TU Delft, Technical University of Delft, has a very strong electrical engineering program. And you know what these schools, the EE schools, are focusing on is like microgrid, nanogrid engineering, like the power systems of the future. So they're churning out these masters and PhD electrical engineers, all focused on DC power systems. You know, vehicle to grid charging, inverters for cars, all that stuff. And they've, you know, the revolution and stuff. You know, look what happened to Cree. Cree ditched LEDs to basically focus on their power electronics. Well, those power electronics are going to become fundamental to running modern buildings, right? So you're going to have these bus bars that are basically, the power is digital. It's a really hard concept to understand, but you don't have, like in the old days, you have an AC, you know, dangerous high voltage, high amperage thing with mechanical switches that then had these DC things on it that would turn the power on and off. And it was just stupid, right? Now you have, you know, MOSFETs and power electronics that can turn the power on and off in fractions of a millisecond, right? So they're safe. They're utterly safe. They're so much safer than AC ever was. And it's precise. You know what the power is. It's all digital. So you're going to have buildings where you're going to be able to centralize a lot of this DC power and control the current and manage all of that from centralized places. So the fixtures don't need it. You don't need this. The light fixtures in a modern office building, right? So, okay, that's the future. So what are the steps to get to that future? Right. I think we're going to go, you know, if you worked like I did, I worked with halogen and dimmable fluorescence, right? You ever tried to do like a Lutron or an ETC Unison system? for like a conference hotel room back in the 90s, right?
Yes, sir.
You had racks of dimmers that would have the fluorescent dimming ballasts and the halogen low voltage dimmers and all
big
of that
closets
stuff. Big closets.
Full of transformers, right?
Now just imagine that, but now it's all state-of-the-art, it's all DC, and it's powering everything in your building. And you control every electron flowing through your whole building because it's generated on your roof and it's stored in the basement, right? You don't need emergency power systems because your whole building is on the battery.
Yeah.
You can run your building for days. So you don't need the Bodine ballast battery and all that garbage. Just get rid of it all, right? So there's some sweeping changes that will happen pretty soon.
Prophet Brad Kerner, the lighting prophet here.
Here's the thing, right? The construction industry moves like glacial speed, and there's so much resistance, and the codes are hard to adopt this. But, you know, I have seen that, like, here in the Netherlands, there's a couple buildings in Scandinavia, entire like academic buildings that are now DC backbone. They were sort of, you know, funded, the equivalent of the US DOE doing R&D funded projects. But ships now, big ships use a lot of DC because, again, they already know the efficiency advantages and the safety advantages. You have DC using for highway lighting because high voltage DC is actually more efficient to distribute than AC, which I always was counterintuitive to what I understood, but they're working on that. So, you know, to me, what are the steps? So like when I was working with Sean and Lightly, I said, don't worry about putting the ballasts or drivers. Sorry, I'm still dating myself, putting drivers in the fixtures. Just go remote right away. Because very soon what you're going to do is you're going to want like a 10 pack of drivers that are all in one box. And you only have line voltage going to that. And that line voltage you just prepare, it's either going to be AC or it's going to be line voltage DC, right? That's the next future. That's what needs to happen right now. And then you have your 10 fixtures all go back to this one unit. You have one IP connection. So it's still smart. Everything is still dimmable, but you have one box that does it all. You only have to address one time. Each fixture is individually dimmable if you want, or you can just have a button and they're all dim on one circuit.
Brad's going wild here, Greg, but I mean,
well, that's the future, right? If you start to,
I don't know if it is the future.
IoT sucks.
I don't know if it is.
Why does it suck? Then go the other way. And how do you simplify all of these systems without losing a lot of the fundamental functions?
I don't know if we're, I don't know if we're prepared for that kind of transformation, Brad. I don't think that can happen in your lifetime. I'm being honest with you, dude. I mean,
oh, I know it. Hey. This stuff, this has been 10 years alone just on this stuff. I mean,
yeah, like you're talking about
unevenly distributed.
Yeah, I mean, and the other thing, Greg, and I know you want to, you're pointing at yourself, you got a big comment to make there. You know, I mean, there's going to be problems with what you're talking about as well. We just don't know what they are yet. And I mean, while you know, the promise of new technology in the beginning, just like LEDs, Brad, is always all the upside without the downside. I mean, we sold this whole thing. We ran around, Greg and I, guilty as sin, swinging through the trees with knives in our teeth, and we sold the best case scenario, not the most likely scenario. Okay, the entire industry. And that these are going to last forever. You're going to save all this energy. They're amazing. That's all old. The news in here. And I think that, you know, once you start down this path, once you start down your path, you're going to discover that there's all manner of problems there too. And that you know, there's going to be, you know, these issues with DC that we haven't yet encountered. And I know that, you know, there seems to be a lot of excitement in that realm and all that sort of stuff. But this is a 100-year project if it ever gets off the ground, Brad.
I think, and you think about the existing buildings too, how do you actually get them wired? That's always been our concern when we've talked to DC people in the past. How are you going to do that?
Yeah, so first off, take it in small bites, right? So pick your applications carefully where it makes the most sense, right? So first off, you don't have to do the whole building, right? You could start with areas where it makes the most sense. So I actually did this very brief stint with this guy who is doing retrofit LED lighting for really down market retail, like Dollar General stores and stuff like that, where he's just taking the old fluorescent troffers, putting LED troffers in. This was years and years ago. He very quickly realized that just by, you know, they only want the lights to turn on. So you don't need like anything for that. And he quickly realized centralizing the DC drivers saved him a lot of money in a super hyper cost conscious retrofit application, right? So that's one thing, you know, I'm talking pendant systems and open offices where you have gangs of the same fixtures. That's another easy low hanging fruit. Multi-unit residential in my mind is another low hanging fruit, right? Because you think about,
can you run DC on existing BX cable? Can you run DC? Can you just change the volt, the supply of the energy?
It just depends. Depends on the gauge and all of that stuff. It depends on what you're doing.
And then what about the electrical? What about the electrical safety authority? What about the electrical safety authorities or the electrical inspectors? What are they going to say?
It's already, I get my classes all confused now between here, but it's already under 48 volts and 100 watts. So it's all like, what do you call that? Class two, class one?
I'm not sure, but.
Do you know what I mean? It's already low voltage safety. So you don't need an electrician to put it in. That standard is already there. It's been there for forever. Right?
Brad, so I think there's a futurist element to you that I appreciate. But Greg, I don't see this as realistic in the next 10 years whatsoever for maybe some very niche applications. You're out in the woods and you don't have any power, so you got some solar panels and some lights. But those batteries don't work in the cold, Brad. And then how do you heat the battery up? And
not
how do you
cold in a building? It's not
yeah,
cold
but
in
then
a
if
building.
The I know, but I mean the number one application. I had this job. The guy had all these railway yards that were remote, these little sheds along the railway tracks that had no power, and he couldn't use the solar lights because the batteries don't work in the winter. There's a lot of different issues that are going to come into play.
Of course. So pick your applications carefully, right? You know.
Yeah.
But I mean, there's already commercial buildings. Here in Europe, there are some in the US too that are already DC backbones. So like it's already moving that way. You already have so many buildings with solar on the roof, right? Everybody wants to get rid of the solar inverters because that's the biggest point of failure in a solar system. So there's enormous pressure there to keep it DC, right? So you just start to add all these trends up and you see there's just a lot of obvious ways that these things are all going to start to come together. Maybe not all at once, but slowly,
I see one major social problem, and a lot of people talk about equity and equality and all this kind of stuff. Blah 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 blah. They talk and talk and talk and talk and talk. But to me, the number one provider of our lifestyle is grid scale energy, and low cost grid scale energy being the fundamental driver of equality. Not, and people look at me when like I'm crazy when I say that. But the areas that are poor in the world, the reason they're poor is because they have no energy. Literally, there's no electricity. And so,
yeah, but I don't buy that story because what happened in the third world with telecommunications is exactly the model. Africa didn't put copper wiring in for telephones everywhere. It just skipped straight to mobile phones. And right now, also in a lot of these third world areas, they're just going straight to solar power, already localized. So if you live in your mud hut and you're poor, you have just enough money to have one solar panel, and then that powers your smartphone and your TV and your communications.
But people don't want to live in mud huts
in
Canada.
And it scales very quickly up from that.
But Brad, people don't want to live. I don't think it does scale. I don't think it does.
Oh, it absolutely scales.
Way off the lighting topic.
All those
yeah, sure. But you need so much land. You need so much land to produce energy with solar. Like a rooftop, what does it create?
Because you don't need much energy. What do you need? What energy do you need?
Stove, fridge, geothermal heat pump. I use a lot of electricity in my house. I don't think and I have a farm. I'd have to put in, you know how many solar panels I'd have to put in and batteries to run that stuff? Never mind the phones plugging in and everything else. The heat pump alone,
that's the future.
A 6-ton heat pump is going to run off solar panels? I don't know. My own
eventually,
solar panels?
Yes. Well, so first off, I'm not saying you're going off the grid. If you watch my DC power presentation, you'll see. You're going to be running off the grid 80 to 90% of the year. And then the other time you will pull power off the grid and you'll put power onto the grid. But the grid is not this kind of one-way flow from power plants to your buildings. Mm. Right? The buildings are islanded. Most of the time they're islands. they're going to start to get really smart. They're going to start to share power between the buildings. And there's a lot of economic reasons they want to do that. And then they're going to start to share power with the grid, right? So that's kind of the next wave of that, right? And then that also, that's how you get the wind power. You get the alternative energy sources onto the grid when you need it, right? And you get the grid scale battery storage and the grid scale stuff, right? So I'm not saying you're disconnecting off the grid, but, you know, again, perfect is the enemy of the good. If you can get 80% of your power needs off the grid, you're going to wait until you get the other 20% to be perfect?
We're way off the lighting topic, but Brad, we've coming up on an hour on this one. We usually try to go 40 minutes. But yeah, I mean, it's an interesting
topic.
That's
the fundamentals, right? You need those secondary innovations to drive other innovations, right? And like stripping the electronics out of the light fixture. When I said that to people, they look at me 10 years ago. No way.
Yeah.
I don't believe that, like a religion that's ever going to happen. Well, now it's very clear there's obvious technical ways to do that, right? And there's a lot of economic factors driving that too. So.
Well, Brad, I thank you for joining us today. Definitely an engaging discussion to be continued. Back from the, we couldn't be at further opposite ends of the lighting industry, I'll tell you that. But, I love the way your brain works. I love the way you think about things. I love the way that you're willing to be critical of some of the obvious problems we have in the industry. But folks, right now, today, the most sustainable company I can think of, Greg, is TCP, tcpi.com.
That's right. They've got all the products you need and the existing fixtures that are in a lot of buildings. And they even have the new stuff too, LED, that's purpose-built. But make a strong push to replaceable light bulbs, and they've got them all.
tcpi.com. Check them out. Brand new portal too for all you distributors out there. All the pricing and stocks in there. That's right. So check them out. tcpi.com. Of course, the National Association of Innovative Lighting Distributors. Go to nald.org. Check them out. And of course, our thanks go to Brad Kerner, the prophet, the latest prophet that has appeared on the Get a Grip on Lighting podcast. He's pointing us to the future. We're going to post a bunch of his links on the Get a Grip on Lighting podcast website. So if you go to getagriponlighting.com, Scotty, I just told him right now to do it, pointed at him. We're going to post all that stuff up there so you can read Brad's work along with his blog and all the other stuff. But for at the end of all this, we rely on you guys, the listeners and the viewers out there. Thanks again. Bye for now.